Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Messini. Tonight, we're continuing our reading of The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. When we left off, the book's narrator, Nick Carraway, was giving us a brief sampling of the guest he'd seen that summer at the parties hosted by his wealthy and eccentric neighbor, Jay Gatsby. Here's Tom Lee reading The Great Gatsby.
From West Egg came the Poles and the Mulreadys, and Cecil Roebuck and Cecil Shane, and Gullick, the state senator, and Newton Orchid, who controlled films par excellence, and Eckhoust and Clyde Cohen and Don S. Schwartzy, the son, and Arthur McCarty, all connected with the movies in one way or another, and the Catlips and the Bembergs and G. Earl Muldoon, brother to that Muldoon who afterwards strangled his wife. Da Fontano, the promoter, came there, and Ed Legros and James B. Rotgut Ferret, and the DeJongs and Ernest Lilly. They came to gamble. And when Ferret wandered into the garden, it meant he was cleaned out, and Associated Traction would have to fluctuate profitably the next day. A man named Clipspringer was there so often and so long that he became known as the Boarder. I doubt if he had any other home. Of theatrical people, there was Gus Ways and Horace O'Donovan, and Lester Meyer and George Duckweed, and Francis Bull. Also from New York were the Cromes and the Backhissons, and the Denikers, and Russell Betty and the Corrigans, and the Kelleher's and the Dewars, and the Scullies, and S. W. Belcher, and the Smirks, and the Young Quinns, divorced now, and Henry L. Palmetto, who killed himself by jumping in front of a subway train in Times Square. Benny McClenahan arrived always with four girls. They were never quite the same ones in physical person, but they were so identical one with another that it inevitably seemed they had been there before. I have forgotten their names. Jacqueline, I think, or else Consuela, or Gloria, or Judy, or June, and their last names were either the melodious names of flowers, or months, or the sterner ones of the great American capitalists whose cousins, if pressed, they would confess themselves to be. In addition to all these, I can remember that Faustina O'Brien came there at least once, and the Baedeker girls, and young Brewer, who had his nose shot off in the war, and Mr. Albrechtsberger, and Miss Hogg, his fiancée, and Ardita Fitz-Peters, and Mr. P. Jewett, once head of the American Legion, and Miss Claudia Hipp, with a man reputed to be her chauffeur, and a prince of something who we called Duke, and whose name, if I ever knew it, I have forgotten. All these people came to Gatsby's house in the summer. At 9 o'clock one morning late in July, Gatsby's gorgeous car lurched up the rocky drive to my door and gave out a burst of melody from its three-noted horn. It was the first time he had called on me, though I had gone to two of his parties, mounted in his hydroplane, and, at his urgent invitation, made frequent use of his beach. "Good morning, old sport. You're having lunch with me today, and I thought we'd ride up together." He was balancing himself on the dashboard of his car with that resourcefulness of movement that is so peculiarly American, that comes, I suppose, with the absence of lifting work or rigid sitting in youth, and, even more, with the formless grace of our nervous, sporadic games. This quality was continually breaking through his punctilious manner in the shape of restlessness. He was never quite still. There was always a tapping foot somewhere, or the impatient opening and closing of a hand. He saw me looking with admiration at his car. "It's pretty sweet, isn't it, old sport?" He jumped off to give me a better view. "Haven't you ever seen it before?" I'd seen it. Everybody had seen it. It was a rich cream color, bright with nickel, swollen here and there in its monstrous length with triumphant hat-boxes, and supper-boxes, and tool-boxes, and terraced with a labyrinth of windshields that mirrored a dozen suns. Sitting down behind many layers of glass in a sort of green leather conservatory, we started to town. I had talked with him perhaps half a dozen times in the past month and found, to my disappointment, that he had little to say. So my first impression, that he was a person of some undefined consequence, had gradually faded, and he had become simply the proprietor of an elaborate roadhouse next door. And then came that disconcerting ride. We hadn't reached West Egg Village before Gatsby began leaving his elegant sentences unfinished, and slapping himself indecisively on the knee of his caramel-colored suit. "Look here, old sport," he broke out surprisingly. "What's your opinion of me, anyhow?" A little overwhelmed, I began the generalized evasions which that question deserves. "Well, I'm going to tell you something about my life," he interrupted. "I don't want you to get a wrong idea of me from all those stories you hear." So he was aware of the bizarre accusations that flavored conversation in his halls. "I'll tell you the God's truth." His right hand suddenly ordered divine retribution to stand by. "I am the son of some wealthy people in the Middle West, all dead now. I was brought up in America, but educated at Oxford, because all my ancestors have been educated there for many years. It is a family tradition." He looked at me sideways, and I knew why Jordan Baker had believed he was lying. He hurried the phrase, "educated at Oxford," or swallowed it, or choked on it, as though it had bothered him before. And with this doubt, his whole statement fell to pieces, and I wondered if there wasn't something a little sinister about him after all. "What part of the Middle West?" I inquired, casually. "San Francisco." "I see. My family all died, and I came into a good deal of money." His voice was solemn, as if the memory of that sudden extinction of a clan still haunted him. For a moment I suspected that he was pulling my leg, but a glance at him convinced me otherwise. "After that I lived like a young rajah in all the capitals of Europe, Paris, Venice, Rome, collecting jewels, chiefly rubies, hunting big game, painting a little, things for myself only, and trying to forget something very sad that had happened to me long ago." With an effort, I managed to restrain my incredulous laughter. The very phrases were worn so threadbare that they evoked no image except that of a turbaned character leaking sawdust at every pore as he pursued a tiger through the Bois de Boulogne. "Then came the war, old sport. It was a great relief, and I tried very hard to die, but I seemed to bear an enchanted life. I accepted a commission as first lieutenant when it began. In the Argonne Forest, I took two machine-gun detachments so far forward that there was a half-mile gap on either side of us where the infantry couldn't advance. We stayed there 2 days and two nights, 130 men with 16 Lewis guns, and when the infantry came up at last, they found the insignia of three German divisions among the piles of dead. I was promoted to be major, and every Allied government gave me a decoration, even Montenegro, little Montenegro, down on the Adriatic Sea. Little Montenegro." He lifted up the words and nodded at them with his smile. The smile comprehended Montenegro's troubled history and sympathized with the brave struggles of the Montenegrin people. It appreciated fully the chain of national circumstances which had elicited this tribute from Montenegro's warm little heart. My incredulity was submerged in fascination now. It was like skimming hastily through a dozen magazines. He reached in his pocket, and a piece of metal slung on a ribbon fell into my palm. "That one's from Montenegro." To my astonishment, the thing had an authentic look. "Ordery D. Danilo," ran the circular legend. "Montenegro Nicholas Rex." "Turn it." "Major J. Gatsby," I read, "for valor extraordinary." "Here's another thing I always carry, a souvenir of Oxford days. It was taken in Trinity Quad. The man on the left is now the Earl of Dorchester. It was a photograph of a half-dozen young men in blazers loafing in an archway through which were visible a host of spires. There was Gatsby, looking a little, not much, younger with a cricket bat in his hand. Then it was all true. I saw the skins of tigers flaming in his palace on the Grand Canal. I saw him opening a chest of rubies to ease, with their crimson lighted depths, the gnawings of his broken heart. "I'm going to make a request of you today," he said, pocketing his souvenirs with satisfaction. "So I thought you ought to know something about me. I didn't want you to think I was just some nobody. You see, I usually find myself among strangers because I drift here and there trying to forget the sad thing that happened to me." He hesitated. "You'll hear about it this afternoon." "At lunch?" "No, this afternoon. I happened to find out that you're taking Miss Baker to tea." "Do you mean you're in love with Miss Baker?" "No, old sport, I'm not. But Miss Baker has kindly consented to speak to you about this matter." I hadn't the faintest idea what this matter was, but I was more annoyed than interested. I hadn't asked Jordan to tea in order to discuss Mr. J. Gatsby. I was sure the request would be something utterly fantastic, and for a moment I was sorry I'd ever set foot upon his overpopulated lawn. He wouldn't say another word. His correctness grew on him as we neared the city. We passed Port Roosevelt, where there was a glimpse of red-belted ocean-going ships, and sped along a cobbled slum lined with the dark, undeserted saloons of faded, gilt 1900s. Then the Valley of Ashes opened out on both sides of us, and I had a glimpse of Mrs. Wilson straining at the garage pump with panting vitality as we went by. With fenders spread like wings, we scattered light through half Long Island City. Only half, for as we twisted among the pillars of the elevated, I heard the familiar jug-jug-spat of a motorcycle, and a frantic policeman rode up alongside. "All right, old sport," called Gatsby. We slowed down. Taking a white card from his wallet, he waved it before the man's eyes. "Right you are," agreed the policeman, tipping his cap. "Know you next time, Mr. Gatsby. Excuse me." "What was that?" I inquired. "The picture of Oxford?" "I was able to do the commissioner a favor once, and he sends me a Christmas card every year." Over the great bridge, with the sunlight through the girders making a constant flicker upon the moving cars, with the city rising up across the river in white heaps and sugar lumps, all built with a wish out of non-olfactory money. The city, seen from the Queensboro Bridge, is always the city seen for the first time, in its first wild promise of all the mystery and the beauty in the world. A dead man passed us in a hearse, heaped with blooms, followed by two carriages with drawn blinds, and by more cheerful carriages for friends. The friends looked out at us with the tragic eyes and short upper lips of southeastern Europe, and I was glad that the sight of Gatsby's splendid car was included in their somber holiday. As we crossed Blackwell's Island, a limousine passed us, driven by a white chauffeur, in which sat three modish Negroes, two bucks and a girl. I laughed aloud as the yolks of their eyeballs rolled toward us in haughty rivalry. "Anything can happen now that we've slid over this bridge," I thought. "Anything at all." Even Gatsby could happen without any particular wonder. Roaring noon, in a well-fanned 42nd Street cellar, I met Gatsby for lunch. Blinking away the brightness of the street outside, my eyes picked him out obscurely in the anteroom, talking to another man. "Mr. Carraway, this is my friend, Mr. Wolfsheim." A small, flat-nosed man raised his large head and regarded me with two fine growths of hair, which luxuriated in either nostril. After a moment I discovered his tiny eyes in the half-darkness. "So I took one look at him," Mr. Wolfsheim said, shaking my hand earnestly, "and what do you think I did?" "What?" I inquired. But evidently he was not addressing me, for he dropped my hand and covered Gatsby with his expressive nose. I handed the money to Catspaw, and I said, "All right, Catspaw, don't pay him a penny till he shuts his mouth." He shut it then and there. Gatsby took an arm of each of us and moved forward into the restaurant, whereupon Mr. Wolfsheim swallowed a new sentence he was starting and lapsed into a somnambulatory abstraction. "Highballs?" asked the head waiter. "This is a nice restaurant here," said Mr. Wolfsheim, looking at the Presbyterian nymphs in the ceiling, "but I like across the street better." "Yes, highballs," agreed Gatsby, And then to Mr. Wolfsheim, "It's too hot over there." "Hot and small, yes," said Mr. Wolfsheim, "but full of memories." "What place is that?" I asked. "The old metropole." "The old metropole," brooded Mr. Wolfsheim gloomily, "filled with faces dead and gone, filled with friends gone now forever. I can't forget, so long as I live, the night they shot Rosie Rosenthal there. It was six of us at the table, and Rosie had eaten and drunk a lot all evening. When it was almost morning, the waiter came up to him with a funny look and says somebody wants to speak to him outside. "All right," says Rosie, and begins to get up, and I pulled him down in his chair. "Let the bastards come in here if they want you, Rosie, but don't you, so help me, move outside this room." It was 4 o'clock in the morning then, and if we'd raised the blinds, we'd have seen daylight. "Did he go?" I asked innocently. "Sure he went." Mr. Wolfsheim's nose flashed at me indignantly. He turned around in the door and says, "Don't let that waiter take away my coffee." Then he went out on the sidewalk and they shot him 3 times in his full belly and drove away. 4 of them were electrocuted, I said, remembering. 5 with Becker. His nostrils turned to me in an interested way. "I understand you're looking for a business connection." The juxtaposition of these 2 remarks was startling. Gatsby answered for me. "Oh, no," he explained. "This isn't the man." "No?" Mr. Wolfsheim seemed disappointed. "This is just a friend. I told you we'd talk about that some other time." "I beg your pardon," said Mr. Wolfsheim. "I had a wrong man." A succulent hash arrived, and Mr. Wolfsheim, forgetting the more sentimental atmosphere of the old metropole, began to eat with ferocious delicacy. His eyes, meanwhile, roved very slowly all around the room. He completed the arc by turning to inspect the people directly behind. I think that, except for my presence, he would have taken 1 short glance beneath our own table. "Look here, old sport," said Gatsby, leaning toward me. "I'm afraid I made you a little angry this morning in the car." There was the smile again, but this time I held out against it. "I don't like mysteries," I answered, "and I don't understand why you won't come out frankly and tell me what you want. Why has it all got to come through Miss Baker?" "Oh, it's nothing underhand," he assured me. "Miss Baker's a great sportswoman, you know, and she'd never do anything that wasn't all right." Suddenly he looked at his watch, jumped up, and hurried from the room, leaving me with Mr. Wolfsheim at the table. "He has to telephone," said Mr. Wolfsheim, following him with his eyes. "Fine fellow, isn't he? Handsome to look at, and a perfect gentleman." "Yes." "He's an Oxford man." "Oh, he went to Oxford College in England. You know Oxford College?"
"I've heard of it."
"It's one of the most famous colleges in the world." "Have you known Gatsby for a long time?" I inquired. "Several years," he answered in a gratified way. "I made the pleasure of his acquaintance just after the war, but I knew I had discovered a man of fine breeding after I talked with him an hour. I said to myself, 'There's the kind of man you'd like to take home and introduce to your mother and sister.'" He paused. "I see you're looking at my cuff buttons." I hadn't been looking at them, but I did now. They were composed of oddly familiar pieces of ivory. "Finest specimens of human molars," he informed me.
"Well," I inspected them, "that's a very interesting idea."
"Yeah," he flipped his sleeves up under his coat. "Yeah, Gatsby's very careful about women. He would never so much as look at a friend's wife." When the subject of this instinctive trust returned to the table and sat down, Mr. Wolfsheim drank his coffee with a jerk and got to his feet. "I have enjoyed my lunch," he said, "and I'm going to run off from you 2 young men before I outstay my welcome."
"Don't hurry, Meyer," said Gatsby, without enthusiasm. Mr. Wolfsheim raised his hand in a sort of benediction.
"You are very polite, but I belong to another generation," he announced solemnly. "You sit here and discuss your sports and your young ladies and your—" He supplied an imaginary noun with another wave of his hand. "As for me, I'm 50 years old, and I won't impose myself on you any longer."
As he shook hands and turned away, his tragic nose was trembling. I wondered if I had said anything to offend him. "He becomes very sentimental sometimes," explained Gatsby. "This is one of his sentimental days. He's quite a character around New York, a denizen of Broadway." "Who is he, anyhow? An actor?" "No." "A dentist?" "Meyer Wolfsheim? No. He's a gambler." Gatsby hesitated, then added coolly, "He's the man who fixed the World Series back in 1919. "Fixed the World Series?" I repeated. The idea staggered me. I remembered, of course, that the World Series had been fixed in 1919, but if I had thought of it at all, I would have thought of it as a thing that merely happened, the end of some inevitable chain. It never occurred to me that one man could start to play with the faith of 50 million people with the single-mindedness of a burglar blowing a safe. "How did he happen to do that?" I asked after a minute. "He just saw an opportunity." "Why isn't he in jail?" "They can't get him, old sport. He's a smart man." I insisted on paying the check. As the waiter brought my change, I caught sight of Tom Buchanan across the crowded room. "Come along with me for a minute," I said. "I've got to say hello to someone." When he saw us, Tom jumped up and took a half dozen steps in our direction. "Where've you been?" he demanded eagerly. "Daisy's furious because you haven't called up." "This is Mr. Gatsby, Mr. Buchanan." They shook hands briefly, and a strained, unfamiliar look of embarrassment came over Gatsby's face. "How've you been, anyhow?" demanded Tom of me. "How'd you happen to come up this far to eat?" "I've been having lunch with Mr. Gatsby." I turned toward Mr. Gatsby, but he was no longer there.
"One October day in 1917, said Jordan Baker that afternoon, sitting up very straight on a straight chair in the tea garden at the Plaza Hotel. "I was walking along from one place to another, half on the sidewalks and half on the lawns. I was happier on the lawns because I had on shoes from England with rubber knobs on the soles that bit into the soft ground. I had on a new plaid skirt that blew a little in the wind, and whenever this happened, the red, white, and blue banners in front of the houses stretched out stiff and said, 'Tut, tut, tut, tut,' in a disapproving way. The largest of the banners and the largest of the lawns belonged to Daisy Fay's house. She was just 18, 2 years older than me, and by far the most popular of all the young girls in Louisville. She dressed in white and had a little white roadster, and all day long the telephone rang in her house, and excited young officers from Camp Taylor demanded the privilege of monopolizing her that night, anyways, for an hour. When I came opposite her house that morning, her white roadster was beside the curb, and she was sitting in it with a lieutenant I had never seen before. They were so engrossed in each other that she didn't see me until I was 5 feet away. 'Hello, Jordan,' she called unexpectedly. 'Please come here.' I was flattered that she wanted to speak to me, because of all the older girls, I admired her most. She asked me if I was going to the Red Cross and make bandages. I was. Well, then, would I tell them that she couldn't come that day? The officer looked at Daisy while she was speaking, in a way that every young girl wants to be looked at sometime, and because it seemed so romantic to me, I have remembered the incident ever since. His name was J. Gatsby, and I didn't lay eyes on him again for over 4 years. Even after I'd met him on Long Island, I didn't realize it was the same man. That was 1917. By the next year, I had a few beaux myself, and I began to play in tournaments, so I didn't see Daisy very often. She went with a slightly older crowd, when she went with anyone at all. Wild rumors were circulating about her, how her mother had found her packing her bag one winter night to go to New York and say goodbye to a soldier who was going overseas. She was effectually prevented, but she wasn't on speaking terms with her family for several weeks. After that, she didn't play around with soldiers anymore, but only with a few flat-footed, short-sighted young men in town who couldn't get into the army at all. By the next autumn, she was gay again, gay as ever.
She had a debut after the armistice, and in February she was presumably engaged to a man from New Orleans. In June she married Tom Buchanan of Chicago, with more pomp and circumstance than Louisville ever knew before. He came down with 100 people in 4 private cars, and hired a whole floor of the Seelbach Hotel, and the day before the wedding he gave her a string of pearls valued at $350,000. I was bridesmaid. I came into her room half an hour before the bridal dinner and found her lying on her bed as lovely as the June night in her flowered dress, and as drunk as a monkey. She had a bottle of Sauterne in one hand and a letter in the other.
For tonight, that's where we have to leave our reading of The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. To listen back to this and many other episodes of The Bookshelf, find them at SpokanePublicRadio.org or subscribe to The Bookshelf podcast. The Great Gatsby is read for The Bookshelf by Tom Lee. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Messini.